is by Myrtle Smith, C.S., of Belfast, Northern Ireland. Let us welcome Myrtle Smith.
Well, the pleasure's mine, and I would like to thank you all for being here, as I thank the last group that we had. I was telling them that when I came here, I had I needed a quiet time of rest and study, and I just felt so much love from everyone here, even though I didn't see many people. I felt the love in everything that everyone did. I felt that everybody loved what they were doing, and I felt such wonderful support from that and what I was doing, that I was allowed to get on with it quietly and with dignity and without any fuss, and all my human needs, every human need just being taken care of. I just thank God every day for 10 acres. It's a very special place, a wonderful place to be, and it's a very needful place. We need places like this in our organization where people can come and pray and rest or be nursed or cared for, whatever. And I'm sure we're all being nursed in the same process. Hello. Well, this little talk that we're having today, and that's all it is, an informal talk to share with you some ideas that I've had in contemplating the thought of nursing and what nursing care is all about, and how really we're all nurses. We're all nursing something and cherishing it. How we need a better concept of what a nurse is. And I took this beatitude because when I was praying about what I would say to you at 10 Acre, the thought of mercy kept coming to me, because we've all heard that old saying that nurses are angels of mercy. And this beatitude kept coming to me: blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And in my life over the last few years, I've had to contemplate the subject of mercy a lot more. And I've had to see how I, even as a practitioner, had been quite merciless on some occasions. And that when I put the quality of mercy to work, it opened the door for the Christ. And there's no healing without the Christ. So we need this quality of mercy to open the door for the Christ. So the subject that I have chosen for this afternoon is: blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Part of the definition of the word nurse is to cultivate with care, to take charge of or watch over, to hold in one's heart or mind, to keep in memory or consideration. All right. What is it we are being asked to cultivate with care or watch over? Is it really a poor, sick mortal, a broken, injured mortal, a demented mortal, a bad-tempered mortal, a frail, lonely, aging, dying mortal? Is it not really the truth that everyone needs to hear, that we have to cherish and cultivate and nurse the idea that God's love for man never ceases? That's what we're nursing, not a person, just the idea that right where that person is hurting, that person is crying out and saying, I need to know that God loves me. That's what that person really needs. It might be in a human form and doing something humanly for them, But back of that is the real need, that they need to know that God loves them, that His love for man never ceases, not even for an instant, that His tender mercies fail not, they're new every morning, as the Bible tells us. And so today I'd like to share with you a few ideas that I've been learning to cultivate, watch over, or nurse tenderly in my own experience. And I've been learning that it's not the nursing of an individual that's important, but nursing the true nature of divine and infinite love, which is universal, impartial, unconditional, and unchanging. And I have also been learning that mercy is one of the greatest attributes of love. Indeed, there's no healing without it. Mercy acts as a key to the door that opens wide to love and prepares the way for the Christ healing. There's no healing without it. We could know all the metaphysical truths in the world, and they wouldn't heal anything if there was no love and no mercy there. Mercy opens the door for love. So this is the real mission or ministry of each one of us. Whether we're practitioners, teachers, lecturers, nurses, administration workers, household or maintenance, patients, whether we're unemployed, it really doesn't matter. One is not more important than the other. We all need each other. I couldn't do my work without you, and you couldn't do yours without me. We're all equally important. We're all involved in the same mission. We've all heard nurses described as angels of mercy. And Mrs. Eddy says, angels are God's thoughts passing to man. So if the thoughts that we are passing to man, to a patient, or to a fellow nurse, or to a member of our family, or a member of our church, is winged with mercy, what a power they become. Let me explain what I mean. About 7 years ago, my only sister died very suddenly. She was not a Christian Scientist, neither was her husband. And unfortunately, she left behind a husband who was absolutely crippled with arthritis. He could do nothing for himself. He was completely bedridden. He couldn't use his hands, his arms. He even had pains in his head. And my sister had to do everything for him. And she died very suddenly, and he was left alone. Now, I had tried to interest him in Christian Science for many, many years. And because of his beliefs in the faith that he worshipped in, he thought that Christian Science was evil, and he would have nothing whatsoever to do with it. He believed that if he suffered in the flesh all his life, it didn't matter, because when he died, he would go to heaven, and he would be perfect, and he would be happy right then, and he didn't want to hear about anything else, and always got very cross when I brought up the subject. Well, when he died, there was no one to take him home, and he didn't want to go into hospital because he missed my sister so much, and he felt that on top of the grief to have to go into hospital to spend the rest of his life there, he just couldn't take it. They only had one daughter who was married to an officer in the army, and he was stationed in Germany, and they were going to have to live there for a further 7 months, and she was not allowed to bring her father there. so they needed someone to take them home for 7 months. Well, they went round all their friends and relatives, his sister and sister-in-law and cousins and everybody, but no one would take on this task. It was quite a big nursing case. And finally, he was left with a choice of either going to the hospital or me. And he chose the lesser of the two evils. He came to me. But he made it very clear that he didn't want any Christian Science nonsense. He didn't want me to try to brainwash him or give him any Christian Science or talk to him about it. And we had to get that perfectly clear, or he would go to that hospital and he would die in it cheerfully. So I promised, all right, I won't give you any Christian Science or anything. And I made him a downstairs room into a bedroom for him. And I gave him a little brass bell beside his bed and told him he was to ring me in the night. And for a couple of weeks he would ring this bell several times in the night because he couldn't turn in the bed. He needed someone to turn him. And this went on for several weeks, and I had quite a few problems and challenges to meet myself. I had a busy practice. I had financial problems. I had a burst pipe in the house, and I couldn't afford a plumber to pay for it. On top of that, I fell and I broke my ankle. And I was trying to look after this man and do all these things. And I had a district nurse come out in the morning and the evening to help me to get him out of bed and into this special chair, wash him and dress him, and then back into bed in the evening. I couldn't go out and leave him alone or anything. And everything I would try to read to him or say to him, even something that wasn't Christian Science, he would immediately get his back up and say, "Don't give me any of that stuff. I told you I don't want to hear it." So this went on for several weeks, and I was feeling quite worn out and sorry for myself. And one night I had a patient who was critically ill, and her family had put the phone beside her in the bed, and I'd been talking to her till about 2 a.m., and I felt really exhausted. And I got into bed and I said, "Father, please don't let that bell ring tonight. Because if it does, I don't think I'll answer it." I was so tired. But I just got into bed when the bell went. And it rang, and it rang, and it rang. And at last I decided, well, I better go down and see what's the matter. But all the way that I hobbled down the stairs in the pain from his foot, the tears of self-pity were running down my cheeks. And I kept thinking, he's so ungrateful. He never even says thanks. He doesn't pay me any money. He takes it all for granted. I'm spending all this money trying to keep his room warm. He doesn't even thank me for that. And he won't let me talk to him. He won't listen. I must be the greatest mug in the world to take all this on. And all these thoughts were pouring into my thought. And just as I got to the bottom step, a little voice said, "Just a minute, Myrtle. Before you go back into that room, or go into that room to see that man, you better sort yourself out. Now, half an hour ago, you were on the phone with your patient. Well, how were you speaking to her? All lovey-dovey. Oh, God loves you, and God is wonderful, and God is love, and how much he loves you. Do you think that God loved your patient and you more than that man, just because you're both Christian Scientists? Do you think you've got a wee pipeline into God that he hasn't? Because if you really think that, you're in trouble. Because there's no one I love more than I love the man in that room. And I can meet him right where he is. If that man believes that when he dies, he'll go to heaven. He has a right to believe what he wants to believe. And you should support the dignity of that. Give the man dignity. To believe that, if that's what he has chosen to believe. But to help to support him. And I felt so humbled by that, that I just stood back and remembered what Mrs. Eddy said once, that she let the Christ go before her into that room. And I opened the door and prayed that the Christ would go before me, that the Christ was there meeting my need and meeting his need. And when I went into the room, he was in tears. He said he had a sore on his leg and he had knocked the top off it. That was very painful. And did I have any ointment or anything I could put on it? And I said I didn't have any ointment. The only thing I had was a baby lotion. And he said, well, maybe that would do it, would cool it. So I had to go all the way back upstairs to the bathroom again, get the baby lotion and the cotton wool. But this time my thinking had changed quite a bit. And I came down and I put this baby lotion on his boot, put a little dressing on it. And when I had finished that, he suddenly said to me, you know, Myrtle, when I was brought to your house, I really didn't want to come here because of all this Christian Science. I wanted nothing to do with it. But I have to admit that since I came to your house, I have felt God's presence more than I ever felt it in my life. And when you were putting that cream on my foot, I felt as if Jesus were with me. And he was saying to me, I'll never leave you alone. I'll always care for you. Trust and don't be afraid. And then he reached up his two twisted, poor old arms, and he put them round me and gave me such a hug. And we both had a good cry. And we talked about my sister and how we missed her and how we loved her. We both got all that out of her system. And we talked about how God was love. And God could meet Tom where he was and me where I was. And that we could agree to disagree. And I came back upstairs, got into bed, had a good night's sleep. The next morning I had a good report from my patient. My foot began to mend, and Tom said, you must get a plumber in today, fix that pipe, and I'll pay for it. He said, and it's time I was paying for my keep. He began to pay for his keep. He began to welcome all my patients and Christian Science friends, would play games of chess with them. And he hadn't written even his name for 15 years. And this was near Christmas, and my sister had bought all her Christmas cards, and I brought them in a pile and said, why don't you start to write out some cards? He said, I can't. And I said, well, try. And I left the cards, and the first day he did 10, and the next day he did 19, till when Christmas came he had written 87, and he had written 5 letters. And we became such friends, and he loved my children, and they loved him. After 7 months, he went to live with his daughter. And just last year, he passed on, and his final request was that he could come home to my house and be buried from my house to be with my sister. And he said to my niece, because I love your Aunt Myrtle more than I loved anybody on this earth beside your mum. Wasn't that nice? A nice healing. And I learned the power of mercy. It wasn't me. It wasn't Myrtle as a person. It was this mercy that I was being shown, that I was being quite merciless by saying, he doesn't deserve this. He's not even grateful. He's so-and-so. And then I had another experience. And that was during the time of the IRA hunger fast in our prisons. I'm sure some of you remember that. It was world headlines. The IRA prisoners in the jail didn't like the conditions in there, and they went on a fast to complain about it. And this fast lasted for days and days and days. So they'd taken off all their clothes. They had nothing but a blanket. It's called the blanket protest. And they painted the walls of the prison with their own human dirt. And every day we were getting shown this on our television screens. It was on the radio. It was in all the newspapers. Everybody was talking about it. The world was discussing it. And we were fed up listening to it. And two of these men had actually died in the prison. And one night I was preparing to go to bed, and I listened to the late night news, and it said that a third man was about to die, that he was on the 52nd day of his hunger fast, and he had become blind. And the authorities said he could only live another 2 or 3 days. Now, I remember thinking, let him die. Well, a lot of them die. That might sort out this problem. Because if he stays in jail, they're in there and they're planning for what they're going to do when they come out, and they're going to cause more havoc. Now, I'm supposed to be a practitioner. And that's how I was thinking. And so were a lot of people in my country at that time. And I remember justifying my anger by thinking about the terrible things that they had done. The people that were blown up, the little children without limbs, people without eyes, people who were killed, people left without homes and businesses. And I thought, really, that my anger was quite justified. But God never lets us away with anything, you know, especially when we're in his service. And for some reason, that man did not die. And not long after that, the hunger fast went over. But months after that, there was a radio program on one Sunday morning as I was preparing to go into church. And I was listening to it because it was a group of IRA terrorists and Protestant terrorists who had met up in jail and become religious. And they'd formed a little group called the Soldiers of the Cross that was trying to get people to come together from all denominations. They were working together to keep people out of these organizations and do different things. And I was very interested in this because I already visited two men in the prison who were on this program. So I was listening to the program, but I wasn't prepared for what happened towards the end of it. Because they interviewed the very man that I've just told you about. This man began to tell us a story, how he was on the 52nd day of his hunger fast. He'd lost the sight of his eyes. He was very, very thin and weak. And the prison authorities said he could only live 2 more days. His mother had brought in the priest, the Catholic priest, to administer the last rites of the church. And as the priest was praying over this man, his mother began to cry. And she said to him, I'm not going to allow you to do this. She said, the IRA can do what they like to me, but I'm going to the prison authorities. I'm going to tell them to take you off this hunger strike and feed you and take you into the hospital. She said, I'm an old woman and I've lived my life. Let them do what they like to me. But she said, you're a young man and I know you've done terrible things, but there must be still something worthwhile about your life. So she said, I'm going off to these authorities. Now he knew that if his mother did that, that she could be in great trouble, or the rest of his family could. They could be endangered because the IRA would not like it. They wanted them to die and be martyrs for the cause. But he said, no, mother, don't do it. I'll do it. And he called in the prison authorities. And you said, I want you to take me off this fast. I'll do it voluntarily. They took him to the hospital. They put him on a drip. They force-fed him. They nourished him. He began to put on weight. He got his eyesight back. And after he'd been in there a few months, they put him back into his own little cell in the prison. In the meantime, they had fumigated the cell. They repainted it. They put in new furniture, even left him new pajamas. And he said that first night, he put on these clean pajamas, he'd had a shower. He felt so nice and clean and glad to be alive that he got down on his knees on the floor and he thanked God that he was still alive. And he asked God to take over his life and do something with it, to bring some meaning or some purpose to it, because he did some dreadful things. And then he remembered that there used to be a Gideon Bible in his locker, and he went to see if there was still one there. And he did. He took it out, and he opened it up where it said, love your enemies, bless those that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you. And he said that he asked God to teach him how to love Protestants, because he didn't know how to do it. He said since he was a child, he was taught to hate Protestants. And he honestly thought that it was a good thing to hate Protestants, and that he should do that, and he didn't know how to do anything else. And he said that night he had the first good night's sleep he'd had in years. He slept like a baby. And the next morning, when the prison guards came round and opened the doors on his side of the prison, they were all the IRA, all the doors on this side. And he said when they opened the doors on the other side, they were the Protestant terrorist groups, the UDA. And he said usually when their doors opened, he used to think, I wish I had a gun. I'd finish every one of you lot off. But this morning he came out and he said he thought, why, they're my brothers, and I haven't known that. We have more in common than there is dividing us. We all love the same country. We all have a passionate love for our country, and we are brothers because God made us all. And that day he made a point of going and meeting a few of these people. And that was how he got involved in this group called the Soldiers of the Cross. And as he was telling his story, he was sobbing. We could hardly hear him. He was crying so hard. And I don't mind telling you, I was sobbing with him. I was on my two knees on the floor, asking God to forgive me for ever condemning any man to death, because that's what I'd done. And I began to realize the quality of mercy that was alive in his mother's thought. A mother's love is the closest love there is to God's love. That mother saw good in her son. And even when I and thousands of people were saying, let them die, right at that minute, someone was praying. His mother was praying. I learned an awful lot about mercy through that experience. And I prayed that day that God would teach me more about his nature as unconditional love. A love that doesn't say, I love you if you're good, or I love you if you conform to what I think is good. But a love that says, I love you no matter what. A love so pure it could only see good in its child. Just like that mother's love. She could only see good. And at the end of the program, a Protestant minister said he would like to read from the book of Hosea in the Bible. Now that's a book that I'm not all that familiar with. I don't think we have it in the lesson sermon very much. But he explained to us that Hosea was a prophet chosen of God. And he was the first prophet to discover that God was love. All the prophets up to Hosea's time thought of God as a hard God, a punishing God. But Hosea's view was softer. He saw God as love. And Hosea was married to a woman named Gomer, and she became a prostitute. And that was a terrible thing for this great prophet, to have a wife who was a prostitute. The second child he didn't think was his, and the third child he knew for sure wasn't his. So he put her out, and she was sold into slavery. But as the idea developed to Hosea that God was love, he began to see that the same things that were happening in his community were the things that were happening in his marriage. That the people in his country had been unfaithful to God, had gone after other gods, had worshipped other gods, had turned their back on all the good that he was giving them. And God told him to go and buy his wife back out of slavery, which he did, for 15 pieces of silver and a handful of barley. And he promised her, I will betroth thee unto me forever. And it did. And it says in the Interpreter's Bible that Hosea became one of the most loving people that ever lived. That he had such an affinity with children and animals that he drew love to them just wherever he was, because he had learned that God really was love. And when he saw what love was like, he became like that love. These lessons help me very much to see how we have to watch our thinking all the time. That whether we're a practitioner or a nurse or whatever, this hardness and criticism and condemnation can get in. And I think that we as Christian scientists are among the most critical people in the world, especially with each other. If something that a Christian scientist had just done happened to someone down our road, we wouldn't think anything of it. But because it happened to a Christian scientist, we're up in arms. Well, they should know better. Why did they do that? Why are they doing that? Are they reading their lesson sermon at all? Are these articles getting through to them? We begin to wonder, and we're so merciless with each other. And part of the definition of the word condemn is to render incurable. So if we condemn a man, like I was doing to that man, we render him incurable. We say he's beyond help, beyond reach. So each time we condemn each other, or a patient, or someone in our family, or whatever, we are shutting mercy out. And when we shut out mercy, we shut out the Christ and love. And it's only the Christ and love that will heal this world. Nothing else will. Not all the bombs, not all the ammunition, not all the plots and the ploys and the trying to agree with each other. Nothing will heal but love. And we don't love another until we see their true spiritual identity. And we can't even begin to see it until we show mercy. But we not only need mercy towards each other, we need mercy towards ourselves. Because sometimes we're so caught up in what we haven't done right in the past. I could have went down with such condemnation as I did that morning when I was on my knees asking God to forgive me for condemning this man to death. And that lasted for a couple of days, but I knew it wasn't right to wallow in it. I lived up to the highest sense of right I knew how to at that moment. But God showed me a higher. And one of our hymns says, love is the royal way. And I wanted to learn through the royal way. So he showed me what mercy could do, the doors that that could unlock. I hope that you find that helpful, and if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, please do. Remember that beatitude, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. It's a quality we don't think of much, and yet it's so very, very important. How merciful are we? You know, even in a shop in a store, I remember going into a store in Belfast not long ago, and every assistant I asked her, do you have such and such a thing? She would say, if it's not on the shelves, we don't have it. And I began to think, well, you know, they can't even serve you properly in the stores nowadays. And what sort of service is this? You know, what sort of people are they? And then I remembered the little quality of mercy. And I thought, well, where's the mercy in that? And maybe you need to express more mercy. So I stood in the queue to pay for this. And I began to wonder how I could express this mercy. And then I noticed there were two girls behind the till to take the money. One had on her uniform, and the other girl had a very pretty pink dress. And I said to her, that's a lovely dress. It was a wet, miserable day. And I said, that's a lovely dress, such a nice shade of pink. And she looked so pleased and said, oh, thank you for saying that. She said, I didn't know whether to wear it or not. We were having a little party after work, because one of our friends is retiring, and I wanted to put on a dress, and I haven't worn this for years, it's so old. And I said, well, it just brightened my day, it just made my day. And the woman behind me said, that's what I thought. And the woman friend said, I thought that too. And the girl in the other tail said, I was just thinking that too. And we all just began to talk and exchange, and it became such a nice, happy experience. And then one of the girls said, what was it you asked me for right there? You know, she said, I think there's some guy in the back. And she just, she went. You see, the quality of mercy had opened the door. It wasn't me. So we can express it in such little ways.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Any questions?
Only one question.
What's that?
I want to make sure I don't forget what you said. About mercy.
You won't forget. They're taking it to you. They're taking it. We're not going to let you forget it. We're not.
The quality of mercy is not strange. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven.
That was it.
And I think that's a lovely definition.
That's right. Yes. Yes, I've been thinking about that the other day and couldn't remember where it came from. It was Churchill.
It was Shakespeare.
There we are. You learn something every day. I've been trying to think about that and trying to remember who
you can make certain if you hear some lovely remark. Chances are Shakespeare.
Yeah. That was nice. The quality of mercy is not strained. Well, he wasn't the only one that made lovely remarks.
He was unique in always saying the right thing at the right moment.
Yes.
Marvelous.
That was nice.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, a man that I visited in the prison sent me a poem. I don't know where he got it from. And it was called The Christ. And I always think that this little poem sums up what the Christ is. I hope I can remember it. It says, not merely in the words you say, not only in your deeds expressed, but in the most unconscious way, is Christ expressed? Is it a beatific smile, a holy light upon your brow? Oh, no. I felt his presence when you laughed just now. To me, 'twas not the truth you taught, to you so clear, to me so dim. But when you came, you brought a sense of him. And from your eyes, he beckons me. And from your heart, his love is shed, till I lose sight of you and see the Christ instead. Isn't that nice? I think that really sums it up. And that's the Christ in action in every nurse, in every activity. And I hope you all see the importance of your work. Mortal mind always loves to put us down and say, what's it all about? What are we really doing anyway? We're not doing anything. You're doing a lot more than you know. There are people in here that you have to nurse who need the dignity, even if they die, to die in quiet dignity, not exposed to the world. They've endeavored to live this science to their highest ability, and they have a right to be sheltered from the world. They have a need of that. They need that dignity. Or they need the dignity that it seems to be taking a long time to work it out. They need the help to do that. Just like my brother-in-law at that minute needed something to be put on that sore. He felt that something was being done. And it was just reminding him that God loved him. That's really all that it was about. That's what he needed to know. So everyone has a right to this quiet dignity. And you're all doing far, far more than you know. When I came here, I had a need. I'd had such a very busy time at home and couldn't seem to get away from phones and so many, many things that I had to do. And I had a need for quiet and rest and study. And when I came here, I just felt it. Though there weren't people in my house all the time. Nobody was making a great fuss. Oh, this is Bert Smith over here, you know. Here was this quiet dignity. I felt that each person went about their job with such dignity and such love for what they were doing that it was a great support to what I was doing. And I felt that, and all the human needs along the way were so beautifully catered for, the food, the accommodation, the someone to look after us and care for us, that I have really cherished this time and seen the need for places like Tenacre. Long may they keep on going. Any more questions? My goodness, you're a shy lot here. Is that? Oh, that's nice. It's a nice size. Good. I think I have to tell you my funny story. As I told the last lot, isn't that right? I told this to one of your nurses, and she asked me to promise to tell it today. Well, I had a patient a few years ago who was a very difficult patient. If you know what a difficult patient is. And she had this belief it was an obstruction in the bowel, but she was very, very hard to help. And no matter how much truth you gave her, no matter how much you asked her to read or study, she'd ask her how she is. But she never asked them that. If you ask mortal mind a question, it always gives you an answer. So she began to go through a whole rigmarole of how she felt that day and the hard day she had and the pain she was in and on and on and on. I couldn't, she wasn't even listening to what I was saying. And then she said, I've just had a lovely soak in the bath. I've been in the bath for about an hour and I was lying there and I was saying to myself, I wonder what God is doing right now. And I said to her, well, you can rest assured he wasn't soaking his bum in the bath. And suddenly I began to laugh, because I pictured God up there in the sky in a big giant bath, and God, what a day I had. That world is driving me nuts. And I laughed so much I cried. I just couldn't stop. And suddenly she started to laugh, and we both laughed together. I went to bed and had a good sleep. And the next morning she rang me, she was the first patient, and she said, you know, right after I spoke to you, the whole thing just effortlessly passed away. And a good laugh did it. And I think God has a wonderful sense of humor. I often find he's laughing at me because they're so stupid. Sometimes it takes so long for us to get the message that God would need a sense of humor. Come on, ask a few questions. Well, Mrs. Eddy taught us that God is father and mother. So that mother was also expressing, I think, the fatherhood of God when she said she didn't care what the IRA did to her. You know, she had this compassion for her son. She saw his worth, she saw his value. At the same time, she was willing to put it into action, to ask the authorities to take him off that fast, no matter what the consequences were. And I think that she also expressed great courage, which is the fatherhood of God. God is father and mother. There's no division and no separation. So both qualities were there. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. If we see and know that we express the motherhood as well as the fatherhood, but I mean from a mortal point of view, from a human point of view, a mother's love appears to be the pure. Though sometimes it happens that the father has more of that sense of love than the mother. I mean, there are plenty of bad mothers who go off and leave their children, and the father would not contemplate such a thing. I'm speaking about the motherhood that could reach out and see that. Whether that's expressed as the father or the mother doesn't really matter. I'm not trying to be sexist, you know. Yes, I don't know the whole citation that, you know, but didn't justice approve in both those cases? Wasn't that divine justice, which is maybe higher than our sense of justice? But my sense of justice said, let him die, you know, he deserves to, he's done all these terrible things. Wasn't that my sense of justice? But God, through showing mercy, also showed a higher sense of justice. And the mercy and the justice together did more for that man than him dying would have done. It did more for his mother. Think what it must have done for his mother to see her son come out of that situation, be reformed. Yeah. Not our human sense of justice, a higher one. Mercy lifts us there. Does that answer that? What about the boys? They're very quiet, aren't they? Yeah, do you think I should? Yeah, right. Well, this is something that really wasn't in my talk, but someone had asked me to share it. It was on one of the Herald tapes that you might have heard that I was on a couple of years ago, called Loving Your Enemies. Well, I was a circulation rep for the Monitor at our church before I went into the practice. This is how I went into the practice. And I sent the two copies of the Monitor into two of our prisons. And two prisoners in there began to write to me. And the funny thing was that they were both in jail on the same crime, but they were in different prisons. Because one said he was a political prisoner, it was a political murder, and the other said, no, he was a criminal, he had committed murder. But both these men, although they didn't know it, began to write to me. They were friends, they knew each other, they were both in different prisons, but they both started to write. And they told me how much they liked the Monitor and they appreciated it. And we began quite a correspondence. And after a while, one of these men told me that he had diabetes and was blind in one eye. And he said a third man who had been on, who'd been in prison with them, were three men who really started off these troubles 20 years ago in that they murdered an IRA man who was in a Protestant pub. And that's how these troubles were sparked off. And the third man to be imprisoned with them had recently died of diabetes. And he'd gone blind in both eyes. And this man, Bobby, had now got it as well, and the authorities told him that they knew about it too late and they couldn't do anything to help him. And he said he knew that he was going the way the other man had gone and that he was going to die and there wasn't anything they could do for him. But he would like to learn more about God before he died. So he asked me if I would tell him what Christian Science believed about God, because he didn't like some of the things that other religious groups in the prison were telling him. So I began to write things about God and sent him articles and sent him a textbook, and he began to read them and enjoy them. And then one day he asked me if I would go and visit him. I agreed to do that, and then I had to be given his mother's pass. She was only allowed to see him once a month. And I had to go on her visiting day, and I had to go through all this business of being searched, and it was quite a business to go through to even see him. And when I saw him, I was absolutely horrified by his appearance. He was so thin, and his face was just clapped away in. And one eye was way down his cheek, and all this horrible stuff was coming out of it. You could even smell death from him. And he began to talk to me about Christian Science. And when our time together was nearly finished, he suddenly said to me, would you pray that I could be healed? He said, I told you I didn't want to be healed. But he said, my father has died since I've come into prison. And I have disgraced my family, and my mother's a widow. And he said she would love for me to come out of prison so that I could see her again. And I would like to do that for my mother, to try and make up to her. So he said, would you pray for me? And I said, well, I couldn't, because I'm not a practitioner. And this case is too serious for me. But I'll ask a practitioner if she would pray for you. And he said, I don't want a practitioner, I want you. He said, I'll take my chances with you. He said, even if I die, I promise you, I won't blame you. And I said, well, that's some consolation, eh? So I said, well, I'll go home, I'll do my best, Bobby, and I'll pray for you. But when I got home, I cried for 3 days and 3 nights because I was haunted by this picture of this man. that I was convinced was going to die and was just so ugly. I couldn't get this picture out of my mind, and then I began to think, and he's a murderer. And what right have I to pray for him because he is a murderer? And I argued and I fought and I battled, and at the end of 3 days I said, well, Father, you gave me this work to do. I sent the monitors into the prison. This is the response. You tell me what I have to do in this case. And the answer came back so clearly. This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. That I had to see that not only was he not a sick man, but he wasn't a bad man. That he wasn't a murderer. That God's son had never committed murder. That the man that they were supposed to have murdered is alive and well. In the Father's bosom, no one anywhere had ever died. So this man was not a murderer any more than he was a sick man. I began to look up words like innocent, innocence, pure, purge, purify. But all these wonderful words out of the dictionary which made up such a big, big treatment. And I began to pray with them. And this man began to respond and come round and began to fill out, began to get better. And then I had applied for class association in New York. And I went to see him one day and I said, Bobby, I have to go to New York for a month. I won't be able to see you. And he began to cry and he said, you can't leave me now because I'm doing so well. And I said, well, I'm not leaving you, Bobby. I'll take you with me in my suitcase. And everything that I learn every day, I will apply it to you. And that's what I did. Every day in class, whatever I was being taught, I applied it to Bobby. After 3 weeks in New York and Boston, I went home. The first Wednesday, I went to church. And a man who wasn't a member then of our church, but visited the prison, stood up and gave a testimony. And he said, I have just witnessed a miracle. I was in the prison on Saturday, and this man who was dying of diabetes and was blind of one eye has been totally healed. His eyes all healed up and he's regained his sight. Now, I was praying all those weeks, but I still couldn't believe it. And I went up to the man and said, is that true? And he said, yes, it is true. His mother's been trying to ring you to tell you. I went home and rang his mother, and she was absolutely overjoyed. And she said, Myrtle, won't you pray that he'll get out of that prison? He won't serve 25 years. And I thought, what have I let myself in for? And I went up to the prison the next Saturday on her card again, and I saw Bobby, and they took my hands, and we danced around this little cell. And he was so delighted, and he said he had been to the prison authorities and medical authorities. They acknowledged his eye had been healed, that he had put on weight, and they said, whatever Christian Science is doing, keep it up, it's good, but you can never, ever be healed of diabetes. Brother was murdered in the Troubles, and he became so embittered that he went out and shot a Protestant. And he was put into jail, and Bobby and him became friends, and every Sunday evening they read the lesson sermon at 7 o'clock, and three hymns. And then he had a sister who had goiter, and the doctors couldn't do anything for her, and Bobby asked her to come and see me, and she said that she didn't like to, that she never went to church, and she wouldn't like to come and see me. And after about 6 months, Bobby was still pleading with her, and I went to visit him one day, and he was very distressed. And he said his sister was getting worse, and he had asked her to go and see me, and she wouldn't. So she said to him, why don't you pray for me? And I said to him, well, why don't you? And he said, what? I'm a murderer. I'm in here in jail for murder. And I said, you know more than your sister. You read that lesson sermon every day. So everything that you read, apply it to your sister. You just say, that means her.
and he did, and she was completely healed in 3 weeks. He had a woman that taught him German, and she came in one day not feeling well. He gave her a German Herald. He told her to take it home and read it, and he would pray for her. She came in the next day healed. 2 weeks later, she told him her marriage was in great difficulty. He found her all these articles, the chapter on marriage. That was healed. Then he began to say to me, "Would you pray that I can get out?" I said, "I don't want you out. You're doing a terrific job." I said, "I think I'd pray that you could stay in here." But one of his problems was loneliness. He had already served at that time 10 years, and it was a 25-year sentence. He'd been engaged to be married before he went in, and the girl had married someone else. And he thought that when he came out, he'd be too old, and because of his prison record, he would never meet anyone. So he said, "How does Christian Science work this one out?" So he began to talk about man's completeness and his wholeness and his satisfaction. And Bobby would look up things. He loved the concordances. He would look up things, write pages and pages. And we did all this work, and he began to feel so contented and satisfied. And then a young boy who wasn't quite 16 shot someone because his father had been shot and came into the prison. And Bobby told him, "People that were bad company, stay out of their way. Don't go near them. Educate yourself. Use this time in here." Told him all the courses he could take, and really took this boy under his wing. The boy introduced Bobby to his mother on the next visiting day. They began to write to each other. The next year, Bobby was suddenly released, and he got out 1 month and was married and had a ready-made family the next month. So wasn't that nice? And you see, mercy was at work there. You know? The argument to me was that there had to be redemption first, that he needed to be redeemed, that he needed to acknowledge what he'd done and so forth. But the redemption really had to be in me. I had to redeem what I was thinking about him. And that was this quality of mercy. And work again. It opened the gate for love to do such wonderful things. Not tremendous. No, that was on a tape, that one. It was a different one on the period. That was about the taxi driver. He's doing very well. The woman that he married goes to the Elam church, who don't like Christian Science, and he goes to her church to keep her happy, you know. But I met him recently, and I asked him how he was, and he said everything was great, but he said, "I don't like that Elam church, but I still do my lesson sermon." So he goes in, he buys the periodicals and the lesson sermon, and he still does that. That's good, isn't it?
Thank you for sharing.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
You have been listening to a lecture by Myrtle Smith, C.S., of Belfast, Northern Ireland.